Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. In July of 1941, virtually the entire Jewish population of the small Polish town of Jedwabne was killed in a single day. And for a long time, it had been assumed that the perpetrators were, in fact, German occupiers. But in 2001, historian Jan Gross touched off a considerable debate in Poland about Jewish-Polish relations when he published a book that argued that the Jews of Jedwabne were not killed by the Germans, but by their own neighbors. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about anti-Semitism in Poland, both before, during, and after World War II. This is a subject that he has done a great deal of writing about and speaking about. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He'll be giving a talk. This is in the MillerCom series on the subject anti-Semitism in Poland after Auschwitz. And that's tonight at 7:30. This takes place at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus. And it is open to the public and free. These talks always are. Over the years, we've had many of the speakers here on the program, and we're pleased to try and bring them to a little bit bigger audience, certainly outside of Champaign-Urbana. Of course, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, you are welcome to attend. Otherwise, questions here are welcome. Our guest, Jan Gross, is a Krauss Family Visiting Scholar here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's also professor of history at Princeton University and has written and teaches on a number of subjects, including Soviet politics and Eastern European politics and society, and also the Holocaust. Two books that I would just like to mention that deal with the subjects here that we'll be touching on. One is the book Neighbors, which is the book that I talked about, the book that's about what happened in Jedwabne. And also, he authored a book that came out just a little bit more recently, and the title of that book is Fear, Anti-Semitism in Poland After Auschwitz, and that's published by Random House. That came out, I believe, last summer. So if you're interested in reading on these subjects, you can certainly go to the bookstore or to the library and look for the books. And questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I do want to mention also that Neighbors was a finalist for the National Book Award. So it did indeed get quite a lot of attention when it was published. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me. This is really wonderful.
The place I guess I would like to begin is to have you tell in brief the story of Jedwabne and what happened there. And maybe just first to do that, say, well, on this day, July 1940, which I...
Right.
10th?
Yeah.
What happened?
Just very briefly, you know, this is, first of all, the context of it is very important. This is immediately after Nazi Germany begins war against Soviet Union. They were, Hitler and Stalin for about 2 years were kind of de facto allies. In June 22nd of 1941, German offensive begins against the Soviet Union. And by that time, the town of Jedwabne is within the borders of the Soviet Union. It happened because in September, when Hitler and Stalin together signed a pact of cooperation, Poland was actually partitioned between the two occupiers. So the beginning of the Second World War for Poles involves both an experience of German occupation and of the Russian occupation, you know. So Jedwabne found itself under the Soviet occupation, and all kinds of things were going on. Let's forget about it for the moment. In any case, when the Germans begin their offensive against the Soviet Union, Jedwabne gets overrun by Nazi troops immediately, still, you know, a day or two after they move their offensive. And this part of Hitler's aggression against Europe and the world was really a very striking and brutal one. The war against the Soviet Union was viewed as a kind of a war of extermination, and this is a time when mass killings of Jews begin by the Germans. So the first thing which one must understand is that there is this exceeding and extraordinary brutality which just begins from one day to another, and directed at the Jews and at the I'm sorry, communists and their allies, presumably. And this is the context. What they do also, once they move in the territories where there is mixed population, Polish, Ukrainian, Lithuanian, and so forth, they very deliberately stir the Nazis, stir interracial conflicts, and invite the local people to somehow settle scores with the Jews, you know. So in that sense, one has to understand that this is not a kind of an outburst of completely random and arbitrary activity on the part of the local population. It takes place in the context of this incredibly violent war where such things were encouraged and condoned. Having said that, one has to take a caveat, so to speak, and look at this episode as it happened. What's so dramatic about it is, first of all, that even though the Germans invited local population to do it and allowed it, of course, to do it, by that time the front had already passed. It's already 10th of July, so there are only a few German gendarmes in the town, and they are visible, and obviously in some ways they mean that the authorities, their presence, are okay with it. But it's the local population that that responds to such an invitation, mobilizes itself, and on that particular day, local people have sort of assembled all the local Jews with whom they lived. Actually, this was a little town in which Jews lived for something like 300 or 400 years already, you know, from generation to generation. They assemble there on the market square, then subject everybody. It's women, children, elderly people, alongside with young men as well. And they are subjected to all kinds of brutalities there. A lot of scores are killed in that stage already of the event. And then in the afternoon, after the hours of such... It's July. It's also very very uncomfortable. It's very hot, you know. People are there, just small children. The local population surrounds, really, that square. And then they are driven into a barn that's situated on the outskirts. Very close, of course, because it's a small town of about 2,500 people. Sort of pushed into the barn. The barn is set on fire and they are burned alive. We don't know exactly what's the score of, but the death toll on that day was certainly in many, many, many hundreds. The number that gets repeated in sources, contemporaneous sources, is 1,600. So I use it as a kind of a symbolically 1,600 throughout the book and stand by it, even though there were some controversies over the number of dead.
Yeah, as I think it's the Polish sort of their official estimate, the Institute of National Remembrance. They say what, between 300 and 400.
They said literally what they said was at least 300. But this is an estimate that's just pulled out of the. Yeah. Out of the air.
And in any case, and this was something that the fact that it happened was known. It wasn't a secret. But for a long time, apparently, the explanation was, the prevailing wisdom was, that it was the Germans that had done this. How was it that then you were able to uncover the fact that no, this was not the Germans that did this? It was indeed, as the title of the book suggests, it was the other people, the neighbors of these people who lived in this little town, yeah, who actually had done this.
You know, if the sort of awareness, the way in which this phenomenon was registered and kept memorialized, so to speak, is quite bizarre. So on one hand, just as you say, there was actually a monument in town, also dedicated to the memory of 1,600 Jews that were killed by the Germans, burned in that barn. That was put up sometime in the 1980s, I think. So that was the official version of history, I suppose. That's how we should call it at the time. But actually, locally, Everybody, of course, knew very well that these were local people who have killed the Jews and were not shy to reveal this. So once you came to town, especially before it became such a blown-up and public issue, and the sort of nationalist public opinion mobilized in order to contest this truth, when you came to town, as many journalists did in prior to the publication of my book, and you sort of started speaking with local people, and they would just tell you right away that this was ours who have killed the Jews, you know, this was a knowledge and memory that was passed from generation to generation, of course, because primarily the people that with whom you would talk would usually be younger people who hadn't been there at the time, and many of them incidentally this is a population that came to this town after the war and was not indigenous to it, so to speak. So it's a very bizarre case of split consciousness on this. On one hand, there is historiography, which doesn't dwell on this too much. It's just the Germans were killing Jews, and there is this monument, and this is just a passing sentence in books about the period that 1,600 Jews were killed in Jedwabne by the Germans. But the moment you start doing some more research, you find out what happened on the ground. Actually, the this was acknowledged in official facts prior to my book. First of all, because there was a trial in 1949 in Poland, in other words, already after the war, in which 22 local residents of Jedwabne, Poles, Roman Catholics, were put on trial essentially for assisting the Germans in doing this. And it came out very openly in the context of the trial. And several people were sentenced, about half of them will go free. What has happened? So there is a record, if you will, of these events preserved in by the judiciary, in which the perpetrators speak and describe it. But what led me to this issue was deposition made by a Jewish witness to these events, who survived the war later on, hidden in the vicinity for the rest of the war, and who after the war left a deposition in the, which was called at that time Jewish Historical Commission, collecting, you know, stories of Jewish survivors. It's like the Spielberg archive, but only avant la lettre, made immediately after these events. It's a fantastic and a very important collection of some 10,000 stories, you know, done immediately. And there is one by a man by the name of Shmuel Wasserstein from Jedwabne. Reading through the archives, I found it, and it just caught my attention. It was so striking and unbelievable. And actually, I must say that for many years, I couldn't come to take it seriously to the very end. In other words, it seemed to me that, of course, what he described, all kinds of cruelties and tragedies that were going on the day, is fine. But then the idea that the local people would just assemble everybody who has not been killed prior to it in some, you know, face-to-face episodes, and push them into a barn and set them on fire, and then 1,500 or 1,600 people would be killed that way, this seemed to me impossible. And then it turned out that it's possible. Mm-hmm.
Just to quickly introduce again our guest, Jan Gross. He is a professor of history at Princeton. He's here spending some time visiting the campus. And if you're interested in reading in greater depth this story, he's written the book Neighbors, The Destruction of the Jewish Community at Jedwabne, Poland. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Came out in 2001. Also as author of a little bit more recent book looks at, again, includes this event, but also more. That book is titled Fear, Anti-Semitism in Poland After Auschwitz, and that's published by Random House. And so you can look at those books, and he will be talking this evening on the U of I campus on the topic Anti-Semitism in Poland After Auschwitz. This is in the MillerCom series, so if you're interested in attending, you can stop by. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Obviously, one of the questions about this event is why, and perhaps not so much why in a larger sense, but maybe also why then, as you explained it, you might have expected this to happen when there were large numbers of German troops, when they were moving through on their way to Russia. But as you expect, as you explained, this was at a time when basically they'd moved through and they'd moved on. There were a few Germans there, but what moved these? And, yeah. and it wasn't. It, I suppose it wasn't for lack of incitement by the Germans, and perhaps we also talk about the fact that there were other places where similar events took place. Yeah. So this was not by any means an isolated event. Yeah. But one still comes back to the question: why? Not only why, but why at that moment?
Yeah. You know, I don't have very good answers, unfortunately. It just strikes me that people who know each other, who are neighbors, literally, for many, many years, should not kill each other. And whenever a killing occurs, unless it's such an obvious, jealousy or some sort of personal grudge that one can identify and then describe as a moment of rage that became uncontrollable, and then we can say, oh yes, this is why the murder took place. I simply don't understand why and how mass murder on that scale could be possible. So I'm saying this, I don't have answers to your question, one can say a few things. First of all, this was a phenomenon. The Germans, first of all, were incredibly brutal and were killing all around as they moved through this area within this space of 2 weeks or so that precedes that lapse between the beginning of German offensive against the Soviet Union and the murder in Jedwabne. And then such killings by local population just started to happen. As you mentioned, this is not an isolated episode. It's a fairly peculiar episode because of the unique, almost. There are three like this that we know about, which take place in a short sequence. Jedwabne comes as last, so one might even say that this is a copycat event. You know, there are three little and not so little towns in the vicinity. One is called Vansosh, the other Radziów, and then finally Jedwabne. The killing spree like this. In other words, if I say like this, and this is what's so unique about this, the Jedwabne episode, and these two as well. It had to do with a very deliberate and careful effort to kill everybody, to kill every Jew, the entire Jewish community, because assaults in which a number, scores, even hundreds of Jews would be killed by the local population take place in this area, in many, many communities, many villages at that time. This became clear after this Institute of National Remembrance that you mentioned in Poland began an investigation of the Jedwabne murder, and in the context of this investigation read very carefully a team of historians and lawyers. They read files of court cases that were brought against perpetrators of killings on Jews during that period after the war in Poland. And it turned out that in 24 villages in the area, there were such killings. But Jedwabne, Radziów, and Wąsosz, actually in reverse sequence, it happens in Wąsosz on the 5th of July, and in Radziów on the 7th, and in Jedwabne on the 10th of July, local population attempted to kill all the Jews. And almost succeeded. From every community, some survived. That's how we know. And they left stories. This was unusual. This was so striking. This is what made it, at least as a historian reading documentation here, one would look at it and say, this is bizarre, because at that time, things like that don't happen. You know, pogrom is not like it usually. A kind of a pogrom situation. Pogrom, you can think of pogrom as a tornado. You know, it goes through a certain area and sort of destroys everything in its path, but it doesn't look and gather people from outside of that path. This was much more like a vacuum cleaner phenomenon, you know, that there was this deliberate effort to get at every speck of human life in that case that was within that community, retrieving people from homes, children, women, bringing them together, and then killing them. This is what made it so bizarre.
You almost wonder whether there wasn't a deliberate intent or a thinking behind it that says, if we do this, if we kill every Jew, then we get to write the story. Then there's not going to be anybody. And we can say anything, and there's not going to be anybody left to contradict and say, "No, wait a minute. No, it wasn't like that."
No, I'm sure this is part of it. I mean, in other words, the notion of not leaving any witnesses, whether it may not be necessarily even the writing of the story that's at stake here. Yeah. It may be actually of their property. Once we take over their property, maybe it's better not to leave any witnesses, because this is in each of these episodes always what immediately follows, and actually what accompanies these acts of violence is a rush on dwellings, you know, that are there that belong to Jews, and just essentially a plunder of everything that's there, and then actually taking over of the housing as well.
When you went back, and I do believe that you went and as much as you could talk to people who had witnessed this, who had been alive and been there at the time. Did you try to talk with people and try to get at how they felt about it, how they felt about it then, how they felt about it now? Did they seem reluctant to discuss it? Did they seem ashamed? Did they just talk about it in a matter-of-fact way that said, well, this is what happened? How did people seem to feel about it?
You know, there was a little bit of all of the above, so to speak. But my main source were really written materials, and written at the time, more or less, these depositions that were collected in the 1940s. Talking with people in 6 years later, almost, is a bit problematic, you know. It's just, first of all, because of their memories, then there aren't that many of them that are still alive. I did speak with, I was able to find some of the Jewish survivors of this massacre, a person who was actually being led to the barn to be killed and then escaped. Other people who were hiding and could observe it from as young boys, those who I went to this village and tried to talk to local people there. There were some who witnessed it and who were just horrified by what they remembered. You know, mm-hmm. I remember a conversation with a woman who was there as a child, and what made this tremendous impression on me. She was just speaking slowly about it, and then at some point stood up and grabbed her head, just covering ears with her hands, and she would say, "But the scream of once they were there. This is," and then you could see that it still sort of haunted her, and it's. So, you know, the main source for this is actually written, and it's copious and very very robust, if I may say so.
And we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that initially, at least for a long time, the main perpetrators, the instigators, were said to be the Germans. Although, as you said, in 1949, there was a trial; people were charged with having, you know, aided and abetted taken place. So there was some acknowledgement that there was local involvement, not to the extent that apparently really happened that you write about in the book. But, you know, having said all that, then now what has been the official position of the government of Poland now on these? Do they acknowledge that, in fact, the story that you tell in Neighbors, the story that you let out here, is in fact what happened?
Oh, sure, yeah. You know, what had happened is that in this Institute of National Memory or Remembrance, they did this immensely complex investigation, and there are two volumes that were published, 1,500 pages altogether, huge also format. So it's really more than 1,500 pages, partly of documents. One volume is documents, and another volume is studies by lawyers and historians, and And there was also a legal investigation of it, because, you know, these crimes do not, there is no statute of limitation on them, and the people could be prosecuted for it. Nobody was in the end prosecuted because one could not find material that could be presented in court and have any of the living perpetrators who had not been put on trial before. Brought to justice. But as a result of these investigations, both historical and legal, the fact has been established that this is the local population had done it. You know, the role of the Germans, if you wish, was for inspiration. In other words, something that's recognized actually already in the deposition of this Jewish witness who says, you know, the Germans gave the order, but this is the Poles who did it. They didn't. And the only dispute, really, which I have with this legal investigation, in any case, is in a needless, but the prosecutor was under tremendous pressure there. Quote which lowers the number of people as a result of something that was really botched. They performed autopsy, not autopsy. How do you call it when you dig the graves?
Post-mortem?
The word would come back. You know, you uncover the site of where these cadavers were buried. Yep. So you go in and you dig. Now, to do this for a mass grave that includes hundreds and hundreds, possibly thousands, of people. I mean, 1,500 or so. It's a procedure that would have to take several months. Now, there it was done in 4 or 5 days, in part to address concerns of the Jewish population. There were Jewish rabbis who said, you know, you don't move remnants of those who are dead. This is part of religious law. But as everything in religious law, this is a disputed issue to the extent that in a case like this, and there was a venue through which it could be overcome, and the investigation could proceed, and this forensic expertise could be done. And on the basis of just 4 days of looking around, the forensic team said, in this mass grave, there can be only 300 to 400, no more than 300 people or something like that. But it's nonsense.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. I have callers that we'll get to in just a moment, but I do want to again introduce the guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. We're speaking with Jan Gross. He's professor of history at Princeton, and in his work is interested in, among other things, Soviet and East European politics and also the Holocaust. He was born in Poland, attended Warsaw University, came to the United States, got his PhD in sociology from Yale, and continues to write and do research on these subjects. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk on the subject anti-Semitism in Poland after Auschwitz. That's tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on West Illinois. This is an event in the MillerCom series. He's also authored two books that you might look at if you'd like to read more on the subject. One, published by Random House last year, Fear, Anti-Semitism in Poland After Auschwitz. And the other is The Story of Yadrobna. It's titled Neighbors, and that's published by the Princeton University Press. Questions certainly are welcome, but as we're now moving into our last 20, 25 minutes, I really have to ask people to be brief. That way we can get in as many callers as possible and keep moving along here. So we will begin first with a caller in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I think the term you all were looking for was exhumation in terms of...
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, indeed, yeah.
A body.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, sir. My question to you, and I've been reading books of late, and one has a subtitle, How Religion Poisons Everything. If I'm not mistaken, were the culprits here, since we're in Poland, were they predominantly Roman Catholics?
They were exclusively Roman Catholics.
Yes, is there any correlation, do you believe, in what some would say, at least in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, a strong anti-Semitic strain or belief in what these local residents did in terms of the carrying out this pogrom against the Jewish residents?
Absolutely. You know, this is a general context of anti-Semitism in Christian Europe, of course, and not only in Christian Europe, in other parts of the world as well. The Catholic or Christian portrayal of Jews as...
Christ killers.
The Christ killers, exactly, and kind of demons that are responsible for all kind of evil. And in Polish church practices before the war, it's not only sort of religious anti-Semitism which was very much present there, but end of 19th century, beginning of 20th century, you move into this sort of social anti-Semitism where the Jewish population is perceived as a kind of a competitor, and there's 3 million Jews living in Poland, before the war, 3.5 million Jews, and there are political parties which make a tremendous appeal, and whose main message is essentially a kind of a nationalist, anti-Jewish and anti-other minorities as well, appeal for, you know, strong national unified politics. So in that sense, there is a background to anti-Semitism that's very firmly established by local practices.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk next with someone in Tuscola. This is line 4. Hello.
Yes, this is quite a tragedy, and I'm thinking of some of the explanations. I know that because of Christian rules and regulations. At one time, early in years, where they were not allowed to charge interest, and the banking seemed to move to the Jews. I was wondering if there was a large number of bankers in Poland that were Jewish. Number one, number two, the Jewish culture also respects education tremendously, and sometimes. As a result, I think the literacy rate for the Jews was exceptionally high, even though the Poles are exceptionally literate, too. But basically, my question is, were the Jews not only a minority and supposedly Christ killers, according to some Catholics, but more importantly, were they extremely successful? And if they were, was this a jealousy factor that might have contributed to this annihilation, and perhaps of this 3.5 million, did they have an unusual political control that most people of a minority and a small population would not have? So that's my question. I'd like to.
Yeah, thank you very much for your question. You know, the Polish Jews were unlike Jews in the west of Europe at the time, whether you think of Germany or France, a population, first of all, smaller numerically, then also quite well assimilated and well-to-do and very well-educated. Polish Jews, in the sort of parlance of Jews themselves, they would be called sort of Eastern Jews, Ostjuden. When Jews from Poland would sort of migrate on their escape to find better place to live and find themselves, let's say, in Austria or in Germany, German Jews would be very afraid of them and would not really would kind of look down upon them as a kind of a status threat to their presence and efforts to assimilate into their own societies. In other words, what I'm saying is that the Jews in the east of Europe, and I include Poland for the sake of argument here, were actually a poor population. They were not assimilated. There was a layer of assimilated Jews in professions and educated lawyers and doctors, not so much in the banking field. It's a few names one could quote, but this is not really a phenomenon of on a social scale. In these villages, Jews were just as poor as everybody else. You don't need big differences in sort of income and social position to perceive others as threat and competitors. So. But for the most part, so to speak, East European Jewry is very poor and destitute, and tries to is actually for several that decades prior to it, runs away from there in order to find a better living. And this is where most American Jews come from, really. They have roots in Poland and further east, Russia.
Mm. So just in if you look at the case of Yad Vabna that we were talking about here, if you look at the way people lived, who they were, what they had, their level of material prosperity, all of that, that they're among the Catholics of the town and the Jews of the town, it sounds as if there would have been very little difference in that way between them.
Very little difference. Very little difference. You know, this literacy, yes, because of the religious practices that Jews are involved in, which require reading the book, so to speak. And from very early on, this is a very religious population, and they train children to be able to do so. And but essentially, they look the same. They live the same way, you know. It's there was no social hierarchy of any kind where Jews as such would end up on the top in these places.
Mm. All right. Well, again, I'll thank the caller and go on to line number two, our next, in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are mm-hmm. you? Interesting subject. In reference to the overall issue, your book is specifically about this event in Poland at this one town, right? I mean, it doesn't deal with the overarching issue of anti-Semitism in Europe and all that stuff, is that
no,
true?
It's about this town.
Okay. Well, I want to draw that a little farther. Daniel Goldhagen's book, Hitler's Willing Executioner, sort of tried to get into the mindset of people that were considered normal and would just, you know, just all of a sudden become mass murderers, I guess is the best way to describe them, and how you talk about, or just a moment ago, about how these people were all neighbors or they sort of knew each other, and then as soon as events changed and they were allowed to turn on the Jewish community, they just basically just said, what the hell, why not? We'll just get them all. And what is the state of the human condition? And I want to ask one other thing. I hear this over and over again. People are appalled at the Holocaust. They're appalled at all this mass murder, as if, like, you know, because it took place in modern era with supposedly an educated population and everybody sort of knew better. And yet, if you look at history, I mean, we could just go on and on ad infinitum. I mean, for instance, look at Rwanda in 1993 when, what, a million people were hacked to death, you know, and thrown in rivers, and everybody just sort of stood by and go, you know, this is disgusting. And then in, you know, Cambodia where they just emptied the cities and killed about 1.5 million people. I mean, I'm trying to bring this into the human condition. Why are people so, why is the West seem to be so appalled at this, but they don't seem to be appalled at anything else? And the reason I say that is because when I was in Southeast Asia 37.5 years ago, I saw things and it was participating in things that were just, I was probably a war criminal in some sense, but mm-hmm. I look at this and think, I mean, I'm hardened to that, and I'm also very cynical about the outlook mm-hmm. because now the Muslims, you know, the radical Muslims think of us as the supposed radical Catholics thought of the Jews. We're all infidels, so are they planning on murdering all of us too? So would you address that issue? Because I think it's a real important issue because I know how your book is really about one event.
Yeah.
Much bigger.
No, thanks very much for your question. I assume that if you refer to Southeast Asia, you refer to Vietnam and your service there, or just at least something that you knew about. But I think you really speak to the a very important issue, and I see in it two aspects. One, if you will, I mean, depending on how one looks at it, it's just, you might say that it's comforting or quite the opposite, very dramatically disappointing. This is a matter of, I think, of a sort of human nature and human kind of a propensity of human beings to do to engage in violence. And just as you put it, it happened in Rwanda, it happened in Cambodia, and it happened very recently, of course, in this war of succession in Yugoslavia, for instance, in the south of Europe, in the Balkans, where people who lived in the same communities, who were neighbors for a very long time, just resorted to incredible brutality. And in that sense, the Polish the assault in these little towns, I'd say, you know, there's nothing to be particularly surprised by it. It's just, this is what people do when a opportunity arises, when they are encouraged, when there is a sense of impunity, and actually and the possibility of drawing rewards, when there is a long embedded sense of difference that sort of runs within the community on religious grounds very often, or the ethnic grounds, as in Rwanda, for instance, where everybody was, I think, Catholic. And so it's very easy to stir in human beings this and lead them to do such acts of incredible, unspeakable brutality. On the other hand, I look at it and say, well, on one hand, you may say nothing new under the sun. On the other hand, you just you tremble because you say, once again, you know, this propensity that we have as human beings for unspeakable violence gets articulated here. As far as Holocaust as being such a terrifying episode, I think there are several reasons for it, and you mentioned some of it. You know, it's just it makes a difference to if you look at it from the point of view of so to speak a member of the Western civilization, to use these very general terms, that such an act of brutality can take place precisely in this kind of a incredibly civilized context. I mean, think of it. It's just Germany. There is nothing that one can do in the domain of literary culture, musical culture, philosophical culture that Westerners consider as their own without drawing on some German sources. How can it be that this sort of bloodletting and the sea of blood can suddenly appear alongside with, you know, Beethoven, Thomas Mann, Mozart, and Hegel, and God knows what else? And I'm just beginning there. So, you know, in that sense, it's just absolutely frightening. And then the other thing which was very frightening was, in the case of the Holocaust, it was the ability to bring in state bureaucracy to process mass murder and organize it in such a manner. That was unprecedented too. So it's a kind of a threat, both in terms of historical roots and in terms of our understanding what modernity is. Suddenly, these modern means, the state as this most sophisticated instrument of organizing our efforts, presumably for the purpose of bringing some sort of welfare to those who live within the domain of its jurisdiction, that's mobilized for something for the very opposite. And that's how I see it. And thank you very much for pointing this out.
I appreciate the caller trying to bring it into this larger context. If we can, I want to haul it back, though, just a little bit to finish up here the last 5-6 minutes to come back to Poland, because I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about what happened at once the war technically was over, because the kinds of things that we've talked about continued. They happened after the war, and perhaps you might talk a little bit about what happened in 1946 in Kielce.
Yeah, well, this is it's a story that has roots in the experience of war, of course, because to my mind it's inexplicable without taking into consideration the fact that local population was deeply implicated in the process that was instigated by the Nazis and aimed at the elimination and killing off of all Jews. It was a very successful process. You know, within Poland, 95% to 97% of the Jewish population was destroyed. And this is something that was incredibly visible and dramatic, because Jews also were people who lived mostly in urban areas. So it's 1/3 of Polish urban population before the war. Just think about it. You know, 1/3 of urban population of a country is no more after this episode. Now, anti-Semitism, it turned out, lingered after the war, and unless one it lingered in a way that, to me as a historian of this period, was just something absolutely stunning. If you think about the misery that was inflicted during the war, how can it be that people still after the war would assault the Jews? But then it becomes clear, you know, if they were implicated in it, if they gained through a killing of Jews, then, just as you pointed out in the case of Yad Vashem, sort of any witnesses that survive, any survivors that appear later on and show up in a little village where the property of everybody who is Jewish has already been taken over, are just a big threat to everyone. And there were a lot of such killings of individual Jews returning from whether camps or God knows, some hiding place, or exile in the depth of the Soviet Union, where about a quarter million Jews found themselves at the end, Polish Jews at the end of the war, deported for the most part as punishment by the Soviets earlier on. So when people were returning, suddenly they instead of kind of, you know, being greeted by their former neighbors who knew them very well and with whom they played as children, they encountered this tremendous hostility, and many were killed. In the city of Kielce, actually, this sort of exploded in an act of urban violence that, if given that this is this takes place not in the context of war, but after the war, this was probably the most and deadly pogrom in Europe in the 20th century, you know. Pogroms, I am excluding acts of mass killings that took place in the context of First or Second World War on Jews. Some 42 people were killed. If one counts those who had been killed in local, in the vicinity, in surrounding train stations on that day, precisely because the population leaving Kielce would then people who were on a train from Kielce would at these stations nearby would start screaming to people in the train that was coming into Kielce that the Jews are murdering Polish children. This was the very bizarre and very strange moment of the Kielce pogrom. The accusation, what brought people into the street, what mobilized that fury and violence, was a medieval blood libel. You know, the accusation the Jews are grabbing Christian children and drawing blood from them in original form. It's because they take it to produce matzah. Of course, this was not a Passover period, so it was not so. This is not what's really foremost on the minds of Christians at the time. But in a very useful variation of that canard, of that mythical story, people were telling, and kind of rumors were circulating that the Jews are drawing blood because they need to fortify themselves as vitamins. You know, they came back from these camps. They are very weak, and they therefore drink that blood in order to get stronger. And in response to this, there was a kind of an escalation of events and the inability on the part of security organizations, whether military, to stem it. And actually, they got people got involved, the soldiers and policemen as well, because they are, after all, human beings and think the same way that their fellow citizens do. And it's just erupted into this horrendous act of murderous brutality.
Mm. And how many people were killed?
The official count is 42. I would say twice as many if you count those that had been killed in railroad stations all around Kielce.
Did something like this happen in Krakow?
There was a pogrom in Krakow that happened. Krakow, incidentally, this is also very important because it's a cultural capital of Poland. This is a really very ancient city, very ancient Jewish community, universities, several universities, and you know, just great tradition. This is in August of 1945. Again, the rumor that circulates is about Jews killing Polish children, and assaults take place all over town on Jews very quickly. They don't develop into the same kind of murderous fury. Somehow, the forces of order, if you will, the police and the soldiers, even though several policemen get arrested for involvement, but they are more disciplined this time, and they stem the tide of this violence. I think one person gets killed. It's unclear whether one or five, and several people are very badly wounded.
Well, we're here at the point that we're going to have to end just our conversation here, But if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and you'd like to hear more from our guest, Jan Gross, he's a professor of history at Princeton, you can turn out for his talk tonight, 7:30, at the Levis Faculty Center. He'll be speaking on the topic anti-Semitism in Poland after Auschwitz, and this is an event in the MillerCom series, so certainly if you're interested, you should feel welcome. Also, there are the two books that we have mentioned. The book that tells the story of Jedwabne, and that book is titled Neighbors. That's published by the Princeton University Press. And that book came out in 2001. Right? And then last year, the book Fear, Anti-Semitism in Poland After Auschwitz, this published by Random House. So those books are there available for you if you would like to read more on the subject. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you very much for having me.